This is The Conversation. It's episode 171 with Claire Collette. She is a Los Angeles-based artist and a fairly recent transplant from San Francisco, not at all unlike recent guest Hilary Petras. Indeed, they know each other. However, Claire is only 2 years into LA, so she has an even fresher take on the situation in San Francisco. It is, as you will find out, not necessarily quite as dire of a dearth of artists up there as you might think. And so we cover that among many other things, including her existentialist roots in France, where she was born. And we get into quite an exchange about abstraction, which we haven't done for a while, the market, and what it all means in the classic tradition of existentialism. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can check out some beautiful images of Claire's studios, both up in the Bay Area and down here, her childhood home in France, which is quite beautiful and pastoral, I have to say, as well as images of her abstract work. So go check those out at the website. And just one other thing that I'll say before we jump right in is that David Rufo, big, big supporter and fan of the podcast, who I'm grateful to have and wish all my fans could be like him, he posted on Facebook some time ago that he was recommending, as he often does, an episode, and he said it's especially good at like the 45-minute mark or something like that. And that indeed was probably the case, but it cannot be said enough that these great moments in a conversation, just like in a movie, are all taken in the full context in which they come. You do not get those great moments. You know, you do not get a satisfying or climactic denouement in a movie that works without everything that came before it. And indeed, in this conversation that Claire and I had, we get to some really great stuff towards the very latter part of our exchange that you have to look forward to. I will just leave it at that. I will talk to you more on the back end. I hope you are having good holidays. This is coming out the day before Christmas for those of you who are either celebrants or just honor it on a secular level, or those of you who don't care because you live in a non-Judeo-Christian locale. That's just an FYI. All right. Hang on for the back end when we're done, and thank you so much for being here. I'll talk to you then.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, where are you?
I'm in Silver Lake in my house.
Silver Lake. Excellent.
Which is also my studio.
Okay. Got it. And how long have you been in Silver Lake?
2 years.
Okay.
Just 2 years, actually, like this week.
Wow, that's exciting. And was it elsewhere in LA, or was it San Francisco before that?
San Francisco, yeah. We moved straight here from there.
Got it. And what neighborhood are you a refugee from?
The Mission.
The Mission.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I lived 10 years in the Mission.
Wow. I know the Mission pretty well, but maybe not well enough to make any good references or anything like that. But I mean, for people who are vaguely familiar with the Mission, you have Mission Street itself, which is kind of the heart of it. And then as you go, I guess, is it south from there, you get into more residential part of the neighborhood?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, and there's Mission Street, and then there's Valencia Street, which are sort of like the main drag.
Right.
And then like nearby is Dolores Park.
Right.
And then, yeah, a little bit south. And I lived only in two different houses the whole time. So at the second house I lived in was just a little bit south of Valencia.
Yeah.
And it's a neighborhood. It's sort of similar in demographics. It's like maybe Echo Park or Boyle Heights kind of thing. Like, I think it went through similar sort of evolutions.
Right. Right.
So it's traditionally like a Latin American or Mexican neighborhood, and then like the art kids came.
Yeah, well, but then the tech kids came.
Goes. Yeah, and then the tech kids came, and then everyone left.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, were you? So do you consider yourself on the kind of the past the midpoint of the exodus from the mission that a lot of people made?
Yeah, I mean, I think that since I was living in a rent-controlled place, mm-hmm. it was easier for me to stay, but also a lot of my friends who were living in rent-controlled houses actually got evicted.
Wow.
So I think, yeah, when landlords saw that, you know, they were able to get double or triple rents, charge double or triple rents, they just started doing these, like, landlord move-in evictions, like, all kinds of things. And actually, you know, I had several friends who were able to sue. I mean, they still had to move, but they got quite, like, a large settlement for having to
right.
move.
Right, right.
Because a lot of it was illegal. But I didn't get evicted, and neither did my husband, who's actually living somewhere, like, just two blocks away from me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we couldn't move in together. You know, I mean, it was, like, really literally impossible to move in together in San Francisco without, like, trying to fit into a tiny studio apartment. Then we didn't want to.
Sorry, did you both have tiny studio apartments?
No, we both were living in, you know, in flats with roommates.
Okay.
And they were rent
right.
control.
Right.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah. Got it. So how is it?
So we just couldn't find a new place.
From your experience, how was it that people with rent controlled or rent stabilized, I guess in some cases, right, situations, mm-hmm. were yeah. landlords able to kick them out? I mean, was one scenario, just to sort of estimate maybe one scenario, that the landlords essentially said, you have to leave, we're kicking you out. And the tenants, not knowing their rights, just acquiesced as opposed to, you know, fighting.
Right.
Or maybe they needed a lawyer in some cases to actually fight.
Yeah. Many people that I know got lawyers. I think it was mostly what I heard of was this, like, landlord move-in thing,
mm-hmm.
where they could say they wanted to move into, like, you know, their unit. But there was other reasons that landlords try to claim, like any sort of breach in the lease agreement. Things that I probably don't, you know, I'm not sure about. But, you know, there are still, it's not like everyone left San Francisco. I do still have a number of friends that are living in the mission,
mm-hmm.
and that's because they have rent control and their landlords, you know, aren't jerks. But a lot
right.
of the businesses had to leave. I mean, there was a lot of like smaller businesses and some galleries and stuff where they didn't have rent control. Like the commercial spaces weren't rent controlled. So
right. Right.
People's studios, stuff like that. People
yeah.
had to leave.
Well, this is something that I think you can speak really specifically to, because the last time that I was, as I told Hillary, your buddy and former, you know, fellow Exodus from San Francisco friend, that that I used to go up to San Francisco pretty much every summer for a good decade or so. And the last time that we went was, I think, 3 summers ago or so, something like that. And we actually stayed in the mission. And sitting in one of those, you know, very contemporary, very artisanal, I should say, cafes.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't
exactly.
help but thinking, who can afford to live here now? You know, who are these people?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so these are just among many thoughts. You know, one of the things that I, by the way, that I should just get out of the way, that I was wondering when we went up there, because I think there had been a little gap maybe since the last time we've been, or there'd been definitely some kind of substantive change, was I was wondering if I was going to see anybody wearing Google glasses, you know, around the city, which I didn't.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. Oh, I saw those. I saw those.
Yeah. Well, you live there, so.
End of my stay.
Right. So anyway, just the first question I think is that like one of the big questions that you had? Like, who are these people that can still afford to live here?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I feel more positive about it now. Like I try, you know, I go back and I have friends that live there, and there's some, you know, we go to the similar venues or bars and you know, there's some great restaurants there that are still happening. And I just went actually over Thanksgiving and had a really great time and was able to go to the same taquerias. And it's not like everything is over.
Right.
You know? But there was a moment when I was still living there, and there was just like this crisis moment where morale was so low, and the art community there was just so discouraged by galleries closing and also just like, you know, small businesses having to move and everyone getting evicted. So I think and I hope that that moment has sort of passed, because since then now there's been this creation of the Minnesota Street Projects. And I think that, you know, the artists there and the arts community really fought back and has worked really hard to hold on and create spaces where they could continue to thrive, whether in San Francisco or in Oakland. And so I think that, you know, and now they just reopened the MoMA. Yeah, I feel like there's definitely sort of a better attitude there now. So I do believe it has changed, you know, fundamentally and irreversibly in some ways.
Mm-hmm. But there's hope, is what you're implying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think that, I just feel like, you know, it will take a lot to beat the arts community down there. It's not
right.
just going to go away.
Right. So. Okay. Well, there's still an arts community there, but I just wonder, you know, and this is very much an outsider's perspective. If you're an artist still in the Bay Area, you're either somebody who was established long ago, you know, and you're one of the few sort of canonized artists that live in San Francisco, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're just like, you're scratching and clawing kind of to hang on, it seems like, you know?
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah.
And that's part of the reason why we left, obviously. But I should say that I was really ready to leave either way.
What was it other than your, you know, not being able to live with your boyfriend? What was it that made you ready?
Yeah, I mean, I had been there for 10 years. I really had never planned to live my whole life there. Like just to, you know, be adventurous and try new things. And I was really itching to live in a sort of a more global art city.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really great, you know, like I was able to convince my boyfriend at the time to move because of it. It was like a pretty obvious thing to do at that point. It was just like, this place isn't supporting us. And I've been wanting to try something new anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see our other options. And of course, New York at the time is just, and still is just so expensive. And our families are both in California. So this was the most logical place to go.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, I don't know if you have much experience with New York, but do you think as an individual, as an artist, it's more affordable to live in one city or the other? Or are they both equally unpredictable and challenging to, I mean,
you
it just
mean
seems
New
like
York
you have,
or,
yeah, or San Francisco. It seems like you have more options in New York just because it's much bigger.
Yeah, I mean, just for jobs, just for art jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really hard to get work in the arts in San Francisco.
Right,
if you, just to get work in the arts and to be, there's just a lot more opportunities. I don't know the difference in, I don't think it's definitely not more affordable to live in San Francisco proper, but probably in Oakland it's cheaper.
Right.
And though I can't say, I haven't checked the rents there for a while, and I know my friends who are there are complaining.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, exactly. Right.
And I feel like LA actually is generally more connected to the larger world than San Francisco. San Francisco is its own bubble.
Right.
It always has been.
Yeah. Right.
Which can be really great and nurturing, and was really great and nurturing when I was younger. And it was more of like a really vibrant art and music scene. But it's like being insulated like that without that there. It's just, it felt really claustrophobic.
Right. And are you, it sounds like you're supporting yourself in similar ways down here that you were up there. Is that correct?
Yeah. So worked for, you know, basically most of the time that I was in San Francisco as a bartender and in the arts. Like I worked at a lot of different nonprofits. I taught, I was involved in different art institutions, but there, again, there was really never any money there.
Right.
So I would always supplement my income by bartending, which actually you can make really good money in San Francisco bartending.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
And it allowed me to not have to work full time. So I could have, you know, time to make art.
Right.
And I bartended through grad school as well. So that was helpful.
Oh, okay. And where did you go to grad school?
Mills is in Oakland.
Which is in Oakland, right. When you were going there, were you living in San Francisco and commuting out there? Or were you
I just stayed. Yeah, I just stayed because I had, you know, my community was in San Francisco and it's not that far of a drive.
Right. Okay. Got it. And what about your studio, though? Was that out there at the college?
Yeah, that was, I mean, I just went there every day. We had these, that was like one of the big appeals for me to go to Mills. It's a really beautiful campus and the studios are really big. They only take 12 students a year in the whole MFA program.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a lot of space and room to work. So, I mean, it's almost like, you know, like a clubhouse. Like I would just go in the morning and stay till like the middle of the night, basically.
Right.
Because there's everything is right there. And there was even like a swimming pool and I took like dance classes and stuff. I mean, I just like, I kind of never left.
Right. Okay. And what do you think, how do you see Mills as a, how does the school fit into the city arts culture as far as, you know, where people come from and then where they go when they finish?
Right. Well, I think it has a fairly good reputation in general there, though CCA is more widely known.
Sure.
In California and in the States.
Right.
It is a really, to me, and what I always sort of gathered from it from afar and what I took from it going there was it, like they have an experimental music department there. They have a really great dance department there. So it is a liberal arts college. It's not just an art school.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what was interesting to me. And, you know, it has a lot of history. Like, you know, John Cage went there and performed there. So I was really interested in that history and even connecting to sort of people in other fields, like the experimental music field. And I actually took some writing classes while I was there. I guess, you know, I'd always struck me as some, like, just a kind of a little hub of avant-garde thinking. I don't know if everyone who went there had that same experience, but since I decided that's what it was, that's what I got out of it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like I got to see Laurie Anderson play while I was there. And some of my teachers, you know, I would gravitate towards the professors who were sort of that mind frame. So,
I would imagine though I was just going to say, it seems that maybe in the past that would have been a place where people from all over would have come. And for some reason, I kind of feel like now maybe people from much closer to the Bay Area would go there. And so what I'm sort of getting at is, I was going to say what I'm kind of getting at is my guesstimate again, sort of outsider's perception is that, like San Francisco, it's a place that people from the area come to and then, you know, people stay in the area, as opposed to, I don't know, you know, other bigger name schools maybe.
You mean like people who go to Mills stay in the area?
Yeah, stay in the Bay Area, right.
I mean, I don't think that's any more true than CCA necessarily, just from knowing from my class. I know that obviously, but that's such a different percentage. But yeah, I do believe that people do come specifically to school to go to CCA and then will leave afterwards. That is definitely true and actually has an impact on the city because of that.
Right.
Whereas, yeah, Mills is definitely, I just don't think it's as widely known anymore in the arts.
Right, right. So when you went to Mills, you were already in San Francisco then, right?
Yeah, I graduated in 2013, so I actually left the year after.
Oh, wow. So this is just a few years ago that we're talking about. Got it.
Yeah.
Right. And why didn't you want to go to CCA? Or did you?
Because I got in and I thought about it, and I think that there would be some advantages to going there, but I really wanted this space, and I just had this, you know, I just felt like Mills was the better place for me and the artwork that I make and what I was interested in. And I didn't really want to go to just a private art school. Right. I mean, Mills is a private liberal arts college, but it's not just
an art school.
So, yeah. And also the studios at CCA are teeny tiny.
Didn't know that. Okay, so that's good to know.
And
yours were pretty
decent
sized?
Yeah, they were pretty big. I haven't had a studio that big since.
Since forever? Is that what you're going to say?
Oh, yeah. No, since. No, I haven't had a studio that big since.
Oh, like, since that time. I see. Sorry.
Yeah.
I misunderstood. Yeah. Well, should we talk about the school that you went to prior to Mills, if that's the right school? Should we get that out of the way?
So I went to the Art Institute of Los Angeles after high school. So this was like, I think I started in 2000 or something.
Mm-hmm.
This was 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a private for-profit design school that is really shitty.
Okay.
And I shouldn't have gone there.
Right.
You know, I guess that's the long and short of it.
Sure. Was there anybody though that warned you, or was there basically nobody sort of in your field that was able to get in the way?
Yeah, you know, I think a few things happened. Like once I was in the school, I realized like, oh, this isn't good. This is not a very good school.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually tried, and this was like a few months in or a year in or something. I remember I tried to go to Otis, and I was like, and they wanted me to start all over. And, you know, it costs a lot of money to start all over. It was just like wasting a year of an expensive school.
Mm-hmm.
So I just didn't do that. But I just didn't know very much at that time. I grew up in Thousand Oaks, and I wasn't part of a visual arts. I didn't know about visual arts. Like, both of my parents were very creative, but they were, you know, more in like the writing and like literature fields, and contemporary visual arts was not in my framework at all. And
right.
I knew I was creative, but I didn't know how to draw. And I wasn't naturally good at drawing. So I thought that I couldn't be an artist because of that.
Right.
Thing. So like graphic design, I think I barely even knew what that was, but I was like, this might be cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, and you know, same thing, like I made the best of it. It's not like every teacher I had was bad. I mean, I studied drawing with a teacher that studied with Lucian Freud, and a lot of my teachers taught at Otis, and I had like, you know, this very radical feminist art historian teaching art history, and she really like actually helped shape a lot of my thinking. So it wasn't that it was all bad, but it certainly is not something that has ever helped me. You know, there's no like cultural cachet from it. I never once worked in graphic design.
Right.
And that was because I didn't want to. I mean, I probably could have. Though I did have friends who went on and were graphic designers and web designers and stuff like that. So.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. That's a more of a mixed picture than I had gotten before, because what it sounds like is you got some pretty good education as far as both training, you know, literal physical training, but and also art history training. It's just that it's something that you kind of have to hide from your resume a bit, you know?
Yeah, it's weird. It's definitely weird. And I mean, I don't want to overstate that either. Like, I think it lacked criticality, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, as far as teaching graphic design, that's definitely what I learned. And, but yeah, it doesn't have a good reputation, and it doesn't have, like the basic credentials that a lot of schools have. So when I was going to apply to grad schools, I couldn't apply to schools in the UC system. I could only apply to private schools.
I see. Right.
Which is a bummer.
Yeah.
Like a real bummer, actually.
Right, right. But, you know, it's... go ahead.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm just going to cough it out.
Yeah, please. Now you have a cold too,
that,
huh?
Right? Yeah, I've had a cold all week. I knew this was going to happen.
Oh, okay. We both have the same cold. Got it. Sorry about that.
You too.
Thanks.
I just was going to say that afterwards, you know, and we can talk about that later, but I took a lot of visual arts classes after undergrad, just to sort of round out my education in the fine arts and stuff. And
you did that between that Art Institute and Mills?
Yeah.
Where was that you were taking the classes?
I went to take classes at San Francisco City College and the San Francisco Art Institute up there had, you know, some classes, and I did a printmaking residency in New York, and I just did a lot just to...
Well, so by comparison...
I mean, I just needed it.
Well, let's look at the Art Institute, San Francisco Art Institute for a second, since you took some classes there. Mm-hmm. How do you think that education, from what you saw of it, even though you weren't there full time, compares to, you know, either Mills or the Art Institute, just as far as the basic teaching, you know?
I think compared to the Art Institute of Los Angeles, which I know, not to get those confused, because that is a chain. The Art Institute of Los Angeles is a chain.
Right, right.
So there's also the Art Institute of San Francisco, which is part of that chain. But then what I'm talking about is the San Francisco Art Institute, which is a private prestigious art school.
Right.
Just for anyone listening.
Yeah. No, I was aware of that, but I'm glad you clarified.
Yeah.
But what I'm sort of getting at is, okay, we understand that these have very different reputations. And when somebody says, where did you go to school? And you say the San Francisco Art Institute, that's very different than saying the Art Institute of San Francisco, right?
But
that's very different. But what I'm trying to get at is, I wonder to what extent, just in the bigger picture of all this, that, you know, there's a ongoing conversation that you hear about whether you should go to grad school at all, right? So I wonder if that conversation is kind of analogous to the conversation about where somebody went to art school at all, you know, like... obviously there are these tribes that you develop when you go to an art school or UCLA or whatever in Los Angeles, you know, or Columbia or whatever in New York, you know, and that sort of becomes your crew, and, you know, you help each other and that kind of thing. But when you have somebody come to your studio and they say, where did you go to school? And you could say Mills, right? You don't have to mention the other school. And they go, oh, okay, whatever, you know. But it's not like a make or break deal as an artist where you went to school, right?
Right. I think that for me, the difference, say, in the actual experience of going to take classes at the San Francisco Art Institute versus the Art Institute of LA is in the student body.
Mm.
It's 100% in the student body. It's like the sensibilities of the student body.
Right, right.
And I mean, it's really, it was just art school kids at the San Francisco Art Institute and kids who are raised with a certain understanding, or at least have a certain understanding, have gathered a certain understanding of not just contemporary art, but other and something else. You know, maybe it's a sort of like hipness that they have, or understanding of culture in a certain way. But yeah, it was definitely the student body.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously going to grad school, I think that can be a debate as well. For me, I'm really, even though it is a crippling amount of debt where it's just like, it's crazy. And I don't really necessarily recommend it to anyone. I also definitely got a lot out of it. And I feel like it most certainly refined my sensibilities in the world of contemporary art.
For sure. Right.
But I don't think that everyone needs that.
Right.
I just want it, you know, I just did.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Got it.
Does that answer your
question?
Yeah.
Thank you for clarifying. So in other words, we could say that whatever kind of socioeconomic background you came from, you know, whether you came from maybe more of a middle class or what have you type of background, you're in the same boat as somebody maybe from a lower income bracket who was also not exposed to art to the extent that both of you needed to, one way or another, get exposure to more contemporary and sophisticated art. And you can't just do that by going to some whatever school and taking some drawing classes.
Yeah. I mean, it's really complex even within that when you start to think about class and race in that mix. But I think that summary does stand.
Am I inadvertently butting up against some race issues here? Is that kind of what you're implying?
No, I don't think so. I just think it's super complex. I don't think anything you said was off the mark. I just think that's like opening up, we could, you know, the Pandora's box of conversation, box of conversation about the art world and how it's a reflection of, you know, America in so many ways.
Well, I wonder sort of maybe the flip side of what you were describing as that, you know, you needed to be an environment where you could be exposed to a more sophisticated framework and context and so on. I wonder sort of if the flip side of that is, to what extent is there in some way an elitism to that, you know, that you that you're not able to get at other places.
And I think that that's real, you know, but it's also like a field of study. So anytime you are interested in a field of study and you want to learn more about it, you're going to get called, at a certain point, it becomes sort of elitism, or people think of it like that because it becomes refined in these ways. But yeah, I think that, you know, not to make this just like the most confusing thing, but I do think that, that conversation about who is going to these things and who is attracted and where you're, you know, what world sort of like raise you up to be prepared for the contemporary art world is an important one.
Yeah. As you're saying that, I was thinking about your bartending, and I was, you know, as another way to look at this, because, and tell me if my guess or my, once again, my perception is fairly close or if it's off. I'm going to kind of imagine that when you're bartending, whether here down here in Southern California or up in San Francisco, that in both places that, you know, maybe somebody, a customer finds out or a colleague finds out that you're an artist, and you get sort of a similar, I can never draw kind of, you know, response, that whole kind of thing. But I also kind of wonder, too, more in a more complex way, if in San Francisco, just because of, you know, we talked about the sort of the smaller bubble of the San Francisco art world versus LA as being more international, if you have those conversations when you're bartending in San Francisco, that you get sort of more indifference or confusion than you do bartending in LA. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, and I think it actually just more depends on the bar, and that's the same here,
Right.
Like the last place I worked in San Francisco was a bar where the manager was a contemporary artist. I mean, he shows at Acme Gallery down here.
Who's that?
Brian Nutarosh was my manager. I hope I'm not like, sorry, Brian, but now he's actually working at Minnesota Street Project, but. Because he was working there, and you know, a lot of the DJs were local curators, and the people that would come in were artists. So that was a very easy place for me to be myself,
right?
You know, and that was actually a really great experience. And I just started working very, very part time at the Mandrake, which is across the street from Blum and Poe. And I imagine, I haven't had much experience there, but I imagine it's going to be very easy for me to talk to people about art. Whereas I also work sometimes at a restaurant downtown, and literally like none of my coworkers, they all love to work, to paint, and they know about art, but like, I don't think anyone there is involved in the contemporary art world in any like daily life kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and then I've worked at bars in San Francisco where they were more like kind of like punk rock clubs and stuff like that. And they don't know about contemporary art. I mean,
right.
They do, you know, but not, again, like not with the same sensibilities. So
did you take the job at Mandrake partially because of its access to the art scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's always felt better for me to work in places, where there was some connection like that.
And how long is that, if you don't mind my asking, that job been going on?
Oh, I just got it like last month, and I'm like really barely there. It's really sweet, but I'm just like filling in once.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, because I just wanted to confirm the word on the street about Mandrake, which is that, you know, because when it started, I don't know how many years ago now it was, 8 or whatever, that, mm-hmm. you know, it was gallerists from the neighborhood would go there and that kind of thing. But the word on the street mm-hmm. is that during the week it is kind of still like that, but on the weekend it's a total bridge and tunnel place. And I just wanted to see if you could confirm that.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Right.
And that's true of basically every bar ever. That, you know, you're gonna have your local crowd in during
right.
the week,
right?
And that's whoever's in the neighborhood, whoever works in the neighborhood. And on the weekend, you know, you get some DJs that play some dance music or something, and then everyone comes into town from other places and
right
drinks all night, and it's fairly annoying usually.
Right. Well, so let's just dig in a little deeper to just your bartending in general, because I haven't had it. I haven't had one conversation yet on this show about bartending. So just tell me, like, what
joys of bartending.
Yeah, well, what are the pros and cons? I mean, obviously, it sounds like it pays really well, which is great, and I'm sure a lot of artists with day jobs listening are probably envious of that. But what, you know, give us sort of a brief overview
right.
of that.
Yeah, so it doesn't pay really well, but it does pay well. Like, my hourly bartending is more than I make when I work in galleries, which I also do sometimes, or
mm-hmm,
work
mm-hmm.
in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine. You know, in some ways there's a lot of positives. Like, if it's a good company or a place and my coworkers are nice, which generally tends to be the case, it can be fine. But, it's, you know, it's, I don't know if you've ever worked in service, it's exhausting and
right.
annoying and
yep.
it hurts your body and
yep.
customers suck. And you really feel like you wouldn't do it if it didn't pay what it did. Like
right.
you're really working for every penny. And then,
right.
And for me, it's never felt sustainable. Like I've always been like, oh, I got to figure out something else to do,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
like something else to do on the side, you know, of being an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I really haven't, it's like, I haven't been able to get away from it completely. I
mm-hmm.
was working in the last year, 4 days a week at a gallery. And even though that gallery was great and everyone was lovely and I was, you know, getting paid like fine, it was really hard for me to go into an office type environment 4 days a week.
Mm-hmm. You mean that
so
gallery
then,
or leaving that gallery and going somewhere else?
Oh, the gallery, I mean. Yeah,
right.
The gallery.
Right.
I mean, working in a gallery is like work behind a computer. You're,
yeah, yeah.
you're doing, you know, that kind of stuff. So.
Why is that part?
Yeah.
Just explain why that part. I mean, going from the bar, say, where you have obvious, you know, like
mm-hmm.
long-term issues, but, and then you're describing going to
right.
the office essentially, even though I don't know, I wouldn't quite equate a gallery with an office, but it has obviously some of the same issues.
No, you're right. You're
yeah.
right. That's not exactly fair, but, well, you know, to make a living working in a gallery, you have to work 5 days a week. I think you'd have to work 5 days a week, full time. With what the hourly generally is.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I think that's just it for me. Just that kind of thing.
So in other words, it was pretty
I've always
lucky.
Tried to set up...
I was just going to say, was it lucky that you only had to work 4 days and have that gig?
Well, I also have bartended.
Oh, I see. So in other words, the 4 days,
yeah.
the 4 days
yeah.
at the gallery wasn't enough on its own.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then I also bartended. So now it's like, I also make some money selling work and stuff, so it just for me, it's like, it makes more sense to make more time for myself to make art, obviously. And it's what I want to do. And it's what I love to do. And it's mm-hmm. who I am.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I always go back to this, well, this isn't making sense for me because I'm not, you know, spending time on my art. And so, yeah, now I'm back in this realm of bartending more and, you know, not working in a gallery. So we'll see how long that lasts.
Well, to what extent, when you just described you need to have time as an artist, though, to what extent was working in the gallery frustrating because you were working for other artists, you know, and that sort of made you mm-hmm. more conscious yeah. of where you were?
Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah.
That's really hard.
Yeah.
It's a weird, and I think a lot of people, artists that I know who have worked at galleries, will say the same thing. Yeah, it doesn't always feel good. I mean, it does. I like supporting other artists. I genuinely do. And I want other people to do really well.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't always feel good to see the other side of it and just,
right.
you know, see like the sales aspect and
yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, it was it's complicated.
It's too much information
I don't
for us
see
artists,
that.
Right?
Yeah. I don't feel like that's a long-term solution for me.
Right, right.
Know,
yeah.
Working in a gallery. But yeah. I do believe in it. I do. It's kind of like that thing where they say everyone should work in the service industry. It's like, I believe every artist should work in a gallery for like 6 months or something.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Just to see how the other side runs. Because
right.
not only is it going to help you know what a gallery is going to expect from you, but what you can expect from a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very helpful for me.
Well, what is one or two things that you can expect from a gallery, would you say, that come to mind?
Well, the gallery I worked for was just really on top of it. I mean, they respond to their emails from their artists. They,
mm-hmm.
you know, set them up with paperwork. They help them with shows that were happening outside of the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they paid on time.
Right.
The miracle of miracles, right?
Right.
So just seeing that and seeing the way they operated, and that's just normal. It's just, and I also understanding where they were coming from
mm-hmm.
when they were dealing with artists and like not happy about certain things. So yeah, it's a good education for sure.
Well, I wonder though if we would just revise what you said about what you can expect as an artist to what you would hope to have as an artist based on your
yeah.
representation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very true. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned, you know, some sales that you've had from your work. So it might be interesting to look more closely at, you know, where you are with that arc. I mean, where have your sales come and how do you see increasing them?
Oh, well, I showed a lot in San Francisco
mm-hmm.
and, you know, just made sales through showing and made even through meeting collectors through grad school and stuff. So
that's
I
nice.
Feel like there was, yeah, I feel like, yeah. So anyways, that has happened. And then since I moved down here, it's been more challenging for sure. Just not knowing anybody.
Right.
I didn't, you know, I was really steadily showing in San Francisco and,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't ever, there is a sort of a glass ceiling. I feel like I hit there where it was like never going past a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
So coming down here, I also, my art making mm-hmm. actually changed a lot
mm-hmm.
when I moved here. So there was probably about a year of experimentation.
Okay.
So I kind of took myself out of, I even said no to some art shows and
mm-hmm.
I sort of took myself out of it, both, you know, as a, like a flow of income and even exhibiting. And in the last few months, I feel like I've made a body of work that like I'm still experimenting, but it's now more within the lines of a specific body of work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm getting more interest. Just from the work I'm making now. And yeah, I've been able to make sales just from people coming and doing studio visits.
How do you, for people listening, why don't you, can you elaborate on how that happens? Is that because they're artists who have enough money to buy your work, or are we talking about collectors?
Mostly it's collectors, and it's people who sort of like know me already. You know, and then yeah, I'm like, exhibiting is the easiest way, and I haven't been exhibiting as much since I've been here,
right?
And that's partly just because I didn't know any, I didn't realize like that I didn't know anyone down here. I mean, I did realize that, but somehow I didn't put two and two together that would like have an effect on everything for a while. So it's taking me a long time just to make the rounds and meet gallerists and meet other artists. And again, like I feel like in the last 6 months, there's been a shift in that where I'm having a lot more people over to my studio and I feel more in dialogue with local artists, which has been really great. But it took a little while.
Well, if you've already been having some sales out of your studio after just being here for a couple of years, I'd say that's pretty great. I mean, that you can't really beat that unless you're somebody who is, you know, going from one gallery in San Francisco to another in L.A. straight away.
Thanks. I mean, it's not, you know, obviously I have my ambitions of where I want to be.
Right.
And I'm not there yet, but I do have a lot of hope and I don't want to say confidence, but you know, like a good feeling. So it's, you know, but it's hard. It's hard to maintain. I think it's hard to maintain being positive,
sure.
Especially during a change like this, when I'm, you know, was less connected to the art community here and was like, how do I even meet anybody? Like, how does this even happen? and then like, you know, over time seeing it happen organically has been good.
Does it feel though that there are a number of people that you know down here who have also left San Francisco?
Yeah. And actually that is helpful in a way because we're a little community, you know, it's like, that's what artists need, their tribe. And we've definitely, a lot of us have found each other and supported each other. So that's been really good.
Right. What about this abstraction thing though, that you have come upon or found yourself in? I know that's a horrible way to ask a question.
No, I kind of like it.
Well, I think
I found myself in another dimension.
Exactly. Well, I think it also alludes to one of my sort of old standby questions, which I actually haven't posed in quite a while. But the question goes something like, so how do you feel about the explosion of abstraction in the marketplace? Which was prompted by, you know, a gallerist that I had on the show's comment a few years back. But in any case, without getting into that for the moment, I think it might be just interesting to hear a very sort of brief encapsulation from you of how you went from this private for-profit art school where, you know, you were taking sort of commercial drawing type classes to making sort of semi-minimalist abstract painting, you know, way down
right.
the road,
yeah.
what that arc is like.
Right. Well, I should say that even when I was at my undergrad, I was always interested in abstraction, and even in design. And I didn't want to do graphic design. I was very anti-capitalist, you know, and still am in a lot of ways.
What does that mean?
Like I was like reading Adbusters and, you
right.
know, I wanted to like burn capitalism down. So I kind of learned more about the industry from going to that school, but also getting politicized around that time. I just knew I was never going to go into that kind of field because I hated advertising.
Right.
So that's, but since then, I mean, let's see, how can I answer this? I'm deeply interested in poetics and in philosophy. And I, you know, I grew up I was born in France, and this like tradition of existentialist philosophies and also religion. And I grew up in a really Catholic family. So I think that taking all of those together has sort of formed my language. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, I was making representational drawings at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
It made much more sense, and I felt like I could communicate much broader through abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
And like recently, I've been really into, just to bring it to like present day, I've been really into poetry and science fiction in the last few years. I've always, you know, I always read a lot and have been really active in that. And I've always felt like that really informed my work. And I guess I kind of think of poetry and science fiction as thought experiments. And I also sort of think of painting like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of it is just me following these threads and sitting with them and trying to create something that feels really authentic from my experience, but they're also me exploring different concepts of like philosophies and sort of like frames of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like the best way to do that was through abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, minimalism has always been very powerful as far as when you can say, you know, when you can create something very powerful out of limited material. I feel like it really opens up doors. And mm-hmm. I've always just been interested in working in that way. That's always been an attempt, you know, an aim of mine is to be able to kind of will something down, like kind of use a reductive process to get down to the root of something.
When you say doors, open up doors, do you mean opening up to the doors of perception?
Yeah, absolutely. And mm-hmm. I'm totally interested in that, in consciousness and exploring consciousness.
Right, right.
And I feel like in some ways, like, why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
Not to do that.
Well, to bring it back around, though, to, as you mm-hmm. said, to bring it back to the present, but then to bring it even further to the present and to the my original sort of kind of oddly phrased prompt about abstraction,
mm-hmm.
how mm-hmm. I, there's this sort of question of abstraction as, you know, speaking of capitalism, you know, as this capitalist mm-hmm. object. So you can be having your yeah. you know, your investigations, but you're ultimately trying to sell your work, right? So how do you reconcile those things? Yeah.
I think that, no, I really believe in that an exchange, that exchange can be a sacred one. I really do. Like, I think it can be a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
As in, like, you want to help me support myself and you love my work, I'm okay with that now, you know. Issues of the marketplace, yeah, that's really hard for me to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because I just don't know what to say. But,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, obviously it's very problematic. And when things get marketed in this way, or they just become formalism, or, you know,
right.
Back to like what Neo Thompson said about creating luxury goods for the ruling class.
Right.
I mean, these are all problems in the art world. And it's not that I don't think about them, because I do, but my answer isn't to stop painting.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That can't be the answer.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a question that I am constantly asking.
Right. Yeah, I mean, especially now with, you know, we're on the tail end of 2016, and activism, as I'm sure you're well aware,
yeah.
is about to be exploded into our consciousness.
It's an important time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an important time. And
yeah.
This will come back around, but I worked as a social activist actually right after undergrad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was a, you know, like one of those paid activists that the Trump people are always talking about.
Right.
I worked for a feminist anti-war organization for a year and a half. And I see obviously what that can do and how important that is.
Mm-hmm.
And I also see the futility in it, you know? And for me to be in this realm of poetics and thought experiments and abstraction is very important. You know, it's very important. And that is a place that makes more sense to me. I mean, I also am an activist still, but, you know, that is like my home, but I also see the futility of that. Right. So there's not a perfect solution, but there certainly has to be room for abstraction and poetics and painted objects, even if we are anti-capitalist and like unhappy with the system. I think that that form of expression and that language is really important to this culture.
Right.
And I mean, I don't buy paintings, but Agnes, you know, it's like Agnes Martin has had a huge effect on me. So the, you know, she created that work and it's out there.
Would you say she's one of your biggest heroes or you know, influencers as an artist?
I think her and Ursula Le Guin, who's a science fiction writer,
right.
Not a painter.
Right.
Definitely Agnes Martin, but I'm not, I mean, I do meditate and do yoga and stuff, but I'm not a Buddhist.
That's okay.
You know, I don't really follow dogmas. I don't think I can go into the desert and I'd be alone for 20 years, but yeah. And, you know, and seeing the effect of her work, you know, and obviously it's been commodified, right? You know, there was like some fashion show with her work in it. I think she would just like roll over in her grave seeing that. But
I didn't know that. But there's certainly,
yeah. And I
was just going to say, certainly there is abstraction that has become fashionable and, you know, is maybe borrowing sort of some aesthetic tenets of her and being turned to into something much more commodifiable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like, that's like that in the music industry too. You know, there's like the good band that all the crappy bands come from.
Right.
So, you know, what can you say? Like, it's problematic.
Yeah.
And it's complicated.
Yeah, that's true.
But, I mean, still, there's, you know, massive amounts of people going to see Agnes Martin at the LACMA or at the Guggenheim, and they're not necessarily trained in, you know, visual contemporary arts, and they're getting something from it.
Is that are you finding that? That's interesting because, I mean, as you said that there are massive amounts of people going to see Agnes Martin, I was thinking, oh well, she was just at LACMA. I didn't actually see the show, I'm embarrassed to say, but but I know that Guillermo del Toro's show was going on there. I would say massive amounts of people went to see Guillermo del Toro's show. I'm not sure that massive amounts of people went to see Agnes Martin's show.
Okay, well, maybe, you know, you're right. I mean, like, massive amounts of people went to see The Rain Room.
Right.
And that's kind of what these shows are for, these,
right.
Like, very populist shows.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people went to see Agnes Martin's show. In the realm of, like,
fair.
You know, in, like, as far as, like, a museum goers went to see her show.
Sure.
And I'm assuming they're getting exposed to this work and
right.
Hopefully, you know, feeling something from it. And it, you know, or maybe it is all people who are versed in visual arts, and that's okay, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just to say that wouldn't it have been a tragedy if Agnes Martin realized, you know, like, thought that, because these works, the way they played off in the capitalist marketplace, like she should just not make them and like not be a creator and just sit and like meditate all day. Right. I mean, I don't think the solution is for artists to stop making art. That would be a crisis.
Right. Yeah.
But I think it's an important conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what we're mulling through basically. And I think just another way to put it is, you know, I think your essential points about it being complicated are well taken, and I think it's a good way to put it. But you did sort of mention, you know, that you were involved with activism and you recognized the futility of it, and you have been, you know, making abstract paintings and been an artist, and you kind of recognize the futility in that. And these are, as you said, I think important questions to be grappling with. I guess I just wonder if what that sort of cycle is with one's own work, because mm-hmm. I feel like with a lot of artists, they just have to kind of put that out of their mind at a certain point. You know, at a certain point, they just have to decide, well, in other words, I think with me as an artist myself and with other artists, I think we have to apply a regular amount of rationalization to what we're doing.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that that's true. I think that that's absolutely true.
Right. Right.
I mean, but we could, like, you know, again, like, I'm kind of brought up with this, like, French existentialism, so mm-hmm, I could keep expanding the circle of, like, what is the point to, like, mm-hmm. everything.
Right.
So it's important for me to dig in and say, like, this is meaningful. It's meaningful to my experience and to my evolution. And, you know, hopefully it has some small impact on the people around me or the people who see it. That's all I can hope for.
Right.
And that's enough. And
right.
That's enough. And it is. And it is. And yeah, like, if it can also sustain me, like, you know, physically sustain me in this world, like, that is great.
Mm-hmm.
And do I want to, like, question and push back against the, like, perils of capitalism at the same time? Yes.
Right. How young were you when you started getting exposed to existentialism? Did they put it in your baby food in France? What happened?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's just like a way of thinking in my family.
And how old were you when you left France?
7.
Oh, wow. Okay. Got it. And where was this? What part?
I was born in a little city called Reims, which is spelled R-E-I-M-S, and it's in the northern, it's in the Champagne
where
region.
One of the giant cathedrals is.
Yes, yeah, the Reims Cathedral, yeah, absolutely. And my family lived in a little farm, like rural, like farming village that, you know, they still live there, actually. It's like some people in my family still live, my grandfather, my uncle still live there.
Mm-hmm.
It's really beautiful. You know, rural France, like, very, very interesting place. But yeah, I feel like that sort of background had an effect on me, as did, like, then, you know, moving to LA and growing up here. So
you went from Sartre country to Thousand Oaks. That's quite a switch.
Thousand Oaks. Yeah, Thousand Oaks is a little bit hard on me, I will admit. It was hard. It was a hard place to be a teenager for me.
How so?
It's actually really conservative, or I don't really know so much about what the culture is there now, but compared to, like, here, to, you know, the, like, this part of Los Angeles,
right,
or even, you know, even, like, the West Side, I think it's really conservative. There wasn't a lot of diversity. It was kind of, like, very stereotypical, like, the jocks were jerks, and
right.
They ruled the school, and there was, like, these blonde girls that were the most popular, and there was, like, a lot of body culture there because it's California.
Right,
And I was just, like, this weirdo, like, kid who was really into reading. And then I just, yeah. So I kind of feel like that kind of confusion led me into my, like, weird undergrad moment.
Right. Like, so were you kind of a mix of the sort of arty girl and the sort of mousy book reading girl, or were you more the latter? What would you?
I was like, well, and then I got into, like, you know, bad stuff. Like, I was going to raves and stuff when I was 16, stuff like that. So I got into, like, that kind of culture here. It was the 90s.
Right.
So I think I was always questioning, like, my reality. Like, from as a teenager, I was always just like, this is very strange, this construct. So that has led me continuously down these roads, these
right.
strange roads.
I can't help but wonder if you have ever had the opportunity to have a conversation about those various constructs with some of your clients in the bars.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely. Definitely. I feel like bar regulars are down for those conversations.
Oh, nice. So you really get to exercise those muscles at your job.
I'm not here. Not in LA. Like,
oh, interesting. So you've just defined the difference between a San Francisco bar goer and an LA bar goer.
Yeah.
So what do they talk about in LA?
I'll just say, like, I haven't worked at a neighborhood bar since I've been here.
Oh, okay.
So I've been working at this restaurant. Yeah.
Right.
So I think it's that. And again, like, maybe if I worked at Mandrake during happy hour, I'd be like this. I'm not sure.
Right.
But you know, San Francisco has these great neighborhood bars. And,
right.
And they're like set up in a way where the bartenders can make like a pretty good money, which I don't know why LA doesn't have so many of these kinds of places. It's weird. But, yeah, like, I would work happy hour and have regulars, and there's all kinds of, like, great, smart, alcoholic, you know, people who want to come in who've read every book under the sun and can, like, talk philosophy till the day, you know, till the sun comes up, actually.
Right, right. When you've had a chance to properly work a neighborhood bar for a bit here in Los Angeles, you'll have to get back on the phone with me and tell me what your typical LA person
Absolutely.
Talks about. Yeah.
I feel like that would actually, and I'm sorry that I can't say now, but I
right.
feel like that actually would be a very good and interesting comparison to
yeah.
make.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, Claire, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This is really fun.
Excellent. And okay. we're out. Thanks so much again to Claire. I have to say, we're doing well with recent San Francisco-based guests, and I hope that continues. And I tell you, a really good sign that I feel like a conversation was really hit its mark is when I listen back as I'm doing the editing, and I go, wow, I didn't even remember it being this good. And indeed, that was the case here. So I hope you enjoy that as well. Wanted to take this moment before we all run for the holiday activity that this is a listener-supported show, as you may well know, and your support is very much appreciated, and I want to entice you, if I can, by letting you know that I just recorded an episode with a very popular past guest. It was a follow-up conversation. It was originally just going to be a like 10-15 minute thing to add to our original conversation, which we had several years ago, but it turned into a little over an hour. So that is going to mainly become another bonus episode, which goes to supporters of the show who donate $20 or more. And so if that becomes you, you will be entitled not only to that, but the other bonus episodes that I have put out recently. And of course, it's very much appreciated and helps this show continue to go and grow. As I may have mentioned, I have a few people helping out. Kate Mitchell has been especially helpful of late, and Chris Ford has been there for a long time, and Cooper Lovano as well. So they are all helping, and your contributions, if they are substantial enough, will give them a little stipend. So, that would be much appreciated. If you can't afford to donate financially, there are other ways you can support the show, including leaving a really great review on iTunes will help more people find the show. That is linked through the website, theconversationpod.com. Of course, you can also become a follower at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. You can become a fan on Facebook. And if you have any thoughts about this episode or others, your comments are always welcome. We'd love to get a dialogue going in some digital form whenever possible. So I hope you guys, if you are in the States and in one way or another, find the holidays unavoidable, and I hope you're enjoying them. If you are in a non-Judeo-Christian location, I hope you are enjoying this latter part of 2016. And so just prior to the new year, just to give you a heads up, we have a flashback episode, and that's going to be a combination, the original episode from 4.5 years ago, as well as a conversation that I just had with this guest. So that should be exciting. I hope you look forward to that. And I look forward to talking to you next week, wherever you are. And thank you very much for being here. We'll talk to you soon. Ciao for now.